We were huge supporters of RTV. And I would say that we made private market. There was no such thing as a private marketplace before we created them. There was no such thing as deal IDs before we initiated. Those conversations happened very organically with the DSPs.
Early to bed, early to rise, eat right and advertise. Early to bed, early to rise. And one more thing, get your name out there.
Hello, and welcome to Paleo AdTech. I'm Marty Kine.
And I'm Jill Royce, and we are the hosts of this podcast that looks at the first two decades of advertising and marketing technology.
From DoubleClick to DoubleVerify and everything in between.
Get your name out there.
This week, we are delighted to welcome Ben Barocas to the show. Ben is the co-founder and CEO of SourcePoint Technologies, a data privacy software company for my favorite kind of people, digital marketers. Before that, he was the co-founder and president of AdMeld, which was one of the leading early supply-side platforms. AdMeld was founded in 2007 and acquired by Google in 2011 for a reported $400 million. Ben worked at Google until leaving to found SourcePoint in 2015. Coming out of college, did you have a particular career path in mind?
My father was an agricultural economist, and so I went to Virginia Tech to study agricultural economics. You know, at that time, I thought I'd go into the Peace Corps and then maybe do SAID, Agency for International Development, or work for one of the Bretton Woods organization, you know, United States Development Program, or the World Food Program or something to that effect. After college, I did some traveling and then went to graduate school at the University of Hawaii and studied tropical agriculture as well. And I had this graduate advisor that took me aside one day and said, you know what, this internet thing, it's gonna be big.
Can you talk to us a little bit about some of these? You founded a couple of companies early, World Rhythm Syndicate and RSM Communications. Can you tell us a little bit
about? World Rhythm Syndicate.
By the way, World Rhythm Syndicate sounds like the name of a band, doesn't it?
Should be the name of a band. There was a great dub reggae collective called Dub Syndicate that certainly influenced our naming convention. Really, it was a music label. And we managed a couple of bands and tried to get them signed, not very successfully. And so it was a short-lived organization, probably a little less than a year when I was still in college. And RSM Communications was the internet cafe and telecommunications startup that I founded in Tel Aviv.
And so how did you end up at AOL managing ad products?
I started when I moved back to the United States after Israel and Germany. A friend of mine recruited me into AOL. He worked for the QA department of the advertising division. And so I started in QA way back when in 2000. And I loved what I was doing, and I loved the people that I was doing it with. I was able to take on and manage a number of different groups. So QA, inventory management, forecasting analysis, and that eventually led to product and managing monetization. I had a great time there standing up the AOL video program. And it's also where I met my co-founder of AdMeld, Brian Adams. So Brian was a senior software architect at AOL in charge of video architecture. And we worked together very, very closely on monetization. And I was very good at breaking things, and he was very good at fixing them. And so, we did some of those seminal campaigns for Chevy and for Lilly. And yeah, it was an amazing time. And did Live Aid in terms of the video streaming and turned that into a very, very, very successful franchise, I would say, early in video streaming. And got to work with early companies in the video streaming space like Lightning Cast, which we eventually acquired, and Bright Cove, which was an AOL Ventures investment, and got a look at, sort of technology startup. And that's when I started to say, hey, you know what? Maybe that's something that I can do. And after 7 years at AOL, went to help someone from AOL start a company called The Fifth Network. That company had its rise and fall very quickly, but also taught me a lot about what to do and what not to do for a startup. And then quickly went to Jump TV, which was also in the video streaming space. We then took public, which was a very exciting opportunity to learn. And that's where I reconnected with my co-founder, Brian Adams, who was the acting CTO. And while standing up their advertising division, also iterated through where some real problems existed in the online advertising ecosystem.
When you were at AOL, were you in Dulles?
I was. And I still, that's really, I grew up very close to Dulles, Virginia. I still obtain a house there. That's where my wife and I both grew up. So I moved there in 1979 and we've had a residence there ever since.
So you mentioned, just briefly, I want to ask about Jump TV. So that business model, they were streaming TV. That was early. Did it work well? I mean, did it have an audience? And
Was it ahead of its time?
Yeah.
It was certainly ahead of its time. It was aggressive. I look at it as like maybe the precursor to Zumo / Fubo, right? Definitely acquired some sports content, but streamed a lot of live international content from places in Indonesia and India, South Africa and Namibia, and along with Spain and China and Japan. And we had hundreds of thousands of subscribers, but it sort of plateaued. And I think the amount of bandwidth that was needed at that time to have a good experience was not ubiquitous. It was almost impossible to have on a phone, right? Like, so the access points to the video and the quality of the video and the caching and the downloading and the DRM and all of those things that we take for granted today were not there. That said,
too slow.
We stood up an advertising program there and made a few million dollars in our first year. And I find that, that was our success. And it's really where we came to the idea of AdMeld. We had rep firms and ad networks all throughout the world monetizing our inventory. And the amount of time and effort it took to optimize those tags and optimize those organizations and optimize those technologies was just overwhelming. And Brian Adams, who I mentioned a few times, that was at AOL and that was the acting CTO of Jump TV, stepped in to try to help. And he said, this is an absolute mess. And it's something that really should be fixed. And we looked at some of the other technologies out there, like Bright Media. It was sort of a walled garden approach to fix the problem. And over a number of conversations, we came to the conclusion that there is a better way. And that better way became AdMeld.
Around the founding of AdMeld, do you remember the moment when that idea occurred? Did you have a napkin? Was there like a whiteboard? Were you in a coffee shop?
There was a lot of conversations with Brian. Brian and I sitting around a table and we talked about this problem and the resources involved in order to fix that problem. And it was clear that wasn't something that was going to be core to Jump TV. And Alex Blum thought, and very rightly so, not only did the idea have legs, but that access to capital was going to be relatively easy because of our backgrounds and our focus. Alex introduced us to an incredible venture capitalist by the name of Santo Politi. And Santo started a venture capital firm called Spark. And we met Santo at the Bryant Park Hotel way back when and had lunch. And we came out of that lunch very, very encouraged. And I guess the rest is history.
Where were you located? Were you in New York, your office?
Yes, in New York. We were always headquartered in New York. Over the 4 years, we opened up 7 offices around the world. Hmm. So in London, in Berlin, in Singapore, in Sydney, in San Francisco, and in Toronto.
Do you remember your very first office, where it was?
Oh, yes. I mean, you couldn't forget our first office on 38th and 8th.
Sketchy.
It's great of you to say that. With the methadone clinic across the street. We took down like half of an artist's loft. We had lots of interesting 3D art on the walls, and you know, one foot in front of the other, true startup fashion. We iterated and iterated and iterated until we found something that worked, and a lot of hand cranking, but some incredible development.
What kind of technology did the team actually build?
It was a lot of technology. So there was both sort of an underlying ad server layer. We were extremely early in AWS. We had moved from having racks at Rackspace, and we worked also very early on, before AppNexus became an ad tech company. Their prior incarnation was trying to develop cloud servers specifically for marketing technology companies. And then when they decided to build their own technology, that was a little bit too close to home. And so we jettisoned AppNexus and moved wholly to AWS. But certainly Mike Nolet and the crew over there, Brian O'Kelly, were instrumental in our development processes in terms of our thinking. And I would say that our development was probably instrumental in them looking at the SSP space, because we were about a year ahead of them. We built technology underlying ad serving, real-time optimization. We had a scraping farm where we went, and this was the days before sort of exposed reporting APIs. And so we would take logins from our clients who had signed up for X amount of networks, and we would scrape their sites for the reporting on a daily basis, and then how we would optimize line items within the server. All of that was built from the ground up.
And so, you know, you were, you know, known, I think, at the time, AdMeld, as a, you know, advertising optimization platform. How is that different than an SSP? Or is it the same?
It is an SSP. I mean, I think lots of those words mean lots of different things to lots of different people. I don't know. We called ourselves the first supply side platform. Whether or not that's true or not, I'm sure there's lots of people that would argue for that title. Whether or not, you know, I think Rajiv and Frank started that same summer that we started. And interesting, you know, we were out first, but both of those companies are very significant juggernauts in their own mind. And for that matter, you know, you look at Jeff Green, and I remember when he came in with a deck talking about the first iteration of Trade Desk. We were like, you know what? There's no sense in doing ad ECN again. You probably should pick a side. Our side is on the supply side. And he was like, it's good advice. And I think he went away and decided to double down on the demand side, and has done incredibly well. And look at how big that company is now. But also, you know, hats off to all of those originators that we all started around the same time, including, you know, Joe Zawadzki and Brian O'Kelly, the guys at DataZoo, the guys at Turn, Maureen Little, and that crew. Was really very, very interesting times.
So the first Trade Desk, that original deck, it had a supply side component. Was it demand and supply?
For sure.
How did you differentiate at the time from competitors like Rubicon and PubMatic?
You know what? We're just better, right? I mean, we were the premium SSP at the end of the day, right? Like, I mean, and also, not to say that, you know, Frank had backgrounds with what was it called? L90. I think that's, he had right. an ad now, yeah. Before, I think Rajiv had an online golf e-commerce company, if I recall correctly. That being said, I realized very quickly that my background was so crucial to not only the operations of the company, but the business development. We were often selling to revenue operations people. And that takes some combination of salesmanship as well as operational know-how. And having spent previous 7 years trafficking ads, it gave me a little bit of a leg up. I spent a lot of time not only as a practitioner, but also creating community around the work that we were all doing. Online advertising at scale was something that very few others did at that time. And I was lucky enough to know personally many of the folks that are at the top of their game, that are still now at the top of the game. That community remains people that are near and dear to my heart.
It's a small world still to this day, I would say. ad tech leadership. It's a small world, relatively speaking.
I would agree.
You can get them all at an ad exchange or conference or IAB. They're pretty much all
And
there.
You do, often.
And you do.
yeah, the founder of AdExchanger, I remember when he coming out of, coming out of Context Web, and I was trying to convince him to come to work for us as our VP of marketing. I remember being at that diner, and, you know, over my scrambled eggs, he told me, you know, sort of the vision for AdExchanger, and I was, you know, one, again, as I am today, I'm very excited about, you know, entrepreneurialism in general. And I said, you know what, that's a good idea. I'm sad you're not going to come to work for me, but I wish you the best. And we were the first sponsor of the AdExchanger blog and the first sponsor of the AdExchanger conference.
The Historical Society. That's it. Yeah.
That's what it is.
'07, 2008, you mentioned, so it was the dawn of DSPs and SSPs, and RTB was much discussed, but there were still ad networks. And in fact, Mike Katz was saying, you know, ad networks are still very relevant and it's too early to talk about real-time bidding. And to what extent did you support RTB with your SSP and things like later private marketplaces? How did you think about the evolution of the buying model?
I mean, this is going to sound ridiculous, but I mean, we were all in from the very beginning. We were huge supporters of RTV. And I would say that we made private market. There was no such thing as a private marketplace before we created them. There was no such thing as deal IDs before we initiated. Those conversations happened very organically with the DSPs. And I think we were able to innovate, certainly on a back end perspective, much more quickly than our competitors. And I think that's, you know, we always had a great relationship with Google, but I think that level of innovation is what was most interesting to them. And I think what eventually led to our acquisition by them.
Because Google had, they were supposedly working on something that looked like a private slot.
Yeah, that something like that.
Was it afterwards?
Yeah, I think a lot of that was afterwards. It's all in those log files somewhere.
Michael Barrett joined the AdMeld at a certain point. What was his role and how did you find him?
Oh, I mean, I worked for Mr. Barrett way back when at AOL for a long time. We were looking for a board member. I met with Michael a number of times. And at some point, it dawned on me that there were a number of skills that Mr. Barrett had that I did not have, managing a board being one of them, and a level of management experience of large teams and fast-growing organizations. But again, this was my first time. And so we decided that it would be great to get him on as CEO. And at that time, I became CRO. And then I hired myself a CRO, Mr. Jason Kelly, and I became president. And I continue to think, if you find people that are better at doing what you're not good at doing, then hire them. And whatever title they want, make that happen.
Great. Fair enough.
How'd the Google acquisition happen? And what was their vision for AdMeld?
And you'd have to ask Susan and Neil what their vision was. But, you know, they wanted our level of growth. We were, you know, while not owning programmatic, our name was synonymous with programmatic. And we had locked up first look with so many of the major publishers around the world. We were a global company. We were growing, you know, 150-200% a year. We were pushing out technologies that were so innovative that they were continuing to change the industry. So not only RTB and private marketplaces and deal IDs, but I think we were the first to take on third-party data. Those were the times of BlueKai and Exalate and Pure39 and Graveshot. And at that time, you know, I decided that publishers really should understand at the bid level why buyers were buying specific impressions. And we laid that data over the bid landscape and made it very, very clear to publishers where there were differences in pricing for specific audiences. So if you were able to do the cookie matching and provide, hey, these really are how many auto intenders you have, and you know the auto intenders are being bid at a $10 CPM, and your news inventory, when it doesn't have a cookie match, is worth 50 cents, right? It might make sense to try to attract more auto intenders. By the way, you probably want to create a price floor at the $8 level so that, you know, no one's able to cherry pick those impressions and then cookie them elsewhere and go find them at a different place without paying you your due. And I think that kind of innovation really changed the game. Publishers knew that, we knew that, and Google knew that. And over time, we were going from strength to strength, and they became focused on acquiring us, and it all worked out.
What do you think, looking back, was AdNald's overall impact on Google's offering?
I mean, it was immense, right? I think, you know, Brian Adams, my co-founder and CTO of AdNald, became the product leader for AdX and, you know, what DFP became. We integrated very, very well, very, very quickly, and deprecated AdNald and baked in all of those features. And, you know, what we always said was that, you know, AdX and DFP are better together, right? And that's exactly what happened. There was a time where we had a choice of being acquired by Google or, you know, raising another $100 million and building our own ad server, which we made the right decision not to, because anyway, well, you can see what happened, right? They had one, but also, you know, you see what happened to Xandr their attempt at building a primary ad server, which, you know, while they had a couple of clients, was never as fully featured as Google Ad Manager. And there were very, very few users of the Xandr publisher ad platform as a primary ad server. They were very successful in creating an SSP, right? A mediation layer, and very successful at creating PMPs. But I would argue that Xandr's publisher platform was not fully featured, and one could not run a very successful publishing business on that ad server alone. And it would be a very costly endeavor today to build a fully featured ad server that could, you know, service the likes of the biggest publishers, you know, in the world, News Corp, Axel Springer, you know, etc.
So you left Google and started SourcePoint in 2015. How'd that happen?
I became frustrated at the pace of innovation within Google around what I felt needed to happen in terms of transparency, right? I believe very, very strongly that the user needs to understand the value exchange that occurs when they provide their data and attention in exchange for content and utility. And I became impassioned. And while I love Google for so many reasons, moving quickly around their what became their consent management platform was happening too slow for me. And I decided to, you know, punch out, raise money, and do it myself. We spent a lot of time sort of developing technology by which there were different kinds of gating to content. But what we realized, in order to get access to top quality content, it was a different kind of financing structure. There's a reason why Hulu was financed by, you know, the top content aggregators in the world and others like them. And so over time, we saw that, you know, GDPR was coming down the pike. I joined the GDPR IAB TCF initiative very, very early on and helped to create sort of that framework and spent a lot of time understanding the details of where do we need to make compromises and how do we explain to the users what they need to know about advertising in order to, you know, consent to what's happening. I also saw, you know, what was happening around iOS and Safari and the third-party cookie going away and identifiers becoming much more constricted. And all of this came together in what we built at SourcePoint. Thank you.